You've heard mothers talk about how their sons have been tortured. You've heard people talk about people being murdered. And you've heard people talk about our movement. We're not just crying out in pain. We also are fighting back. And we need your help to continue this fight back. Because this summer, what we want to do, we want to put CPAC committees in all 50 wards. Now, we may not get all 50, but we're going to get most of them. Because this is the only way that we are going to send an undeniable message to these politicians who refuse to get off their rusty dusties and do anything about the police murdering our people.
How's everybody doing? All right, good. And Frank, we didn't mean to leave you hanging up here. I think I just want to say our family would like to make a donation in memory of Clarice Durham and Josephine Wyatt, who every year made sure we were at these events, even as we went to many other things. So I'm going to be very brief because I know people want to hear our brilliant sister, Angela Davis. Yes, right? So here's to brevity. So I remember Trinity Church, though, when I first came to Chicago, because Trinity was one of the places that had an early AIDS ministry. Trinity was one of the places where we could meet as anti-apartheid activists. And I just want to start us off, those of you who remember those days, there was a chant that came out of the South African freedom struggle, which meant power to the people. And then as one person said, Amandla, and the crowd said, Awetu. So I'm going to say that to you, and I'm hoping that you'll say Awetu back. Amandla.
Awetu.
Amandla.
Awetu.
Amandla.
Awetu.
Thank you. I'm speaking for the R3 Coalition, Resist, Reimagine, Rebuild, because that's what we need to do here in Chicago and beyond. I'm happy to speak in solidarity with CPAC, with the Chicago Alliance, with the amazing people who have been leading this movement in this city, my political family. I want to also welcome back our brothers who we love mightily, who have been caged in the prisons of this state, and we pledge to continue to fight, as one of the previous speakers said, until they are all free. I have two thoughts to share with you today. One is the importance of intergenerational community in this struggle, and I'm glad to see the speakers here reflected that. We have to have a sense of history, and we have to have a commitment to the long game, right? And there are many people whose example in this room have taught us that. Certainly Angela Davis, who has been there at every critical turning point in the struggle for freedom in this country and around the world. People in this city like Frank Chapman, like Mildred and Willie Williamson, like my brother Stan Willis. And I remember when I first came to Chicago, Stan Willis dragged me to a meeting in somebody's basement where he was convincing people to sue the police. So this is a long struggle. It's been going on a long time. People like Michael Elliott, who struggle and contribute quietly and humbly year after year. That is important for us to remember going forward. I think we also have to remember to be radically inclusive, to break down the silos and to build bridges that connect our communities and connect our struggles, because violence against Black and brown and poor people comes in many different forms, and so we have to deal with and address the pain of all of our people. We have to build a movement that includes undocumented brothers and sisters. We have to build a movement that includes our LGBTQ brothers and sisters. We have to build a movement that includes incarcerated and formerly incarcerated. And we have to remember our Puerto Rican family. Yesterday was a Puerto Rican Day parade, and former political prisoner Oscar Lopez Rivera was here in Chicago. We have to remember our Palestinian family suffering under Israeli tyranny in Gaza, because we can't do this alone. Finally, I want to say happy Father's Day, belatedly, to the fathers in the room. And we love our fathers, sons, brothers, uncles on this day. I remember my own father, hardworking, long-struggling man on this day. But what I also want to say is we also have to remember the women who have been in the forefront of this struggle, women who have also been the victims and continue to be the victims of police violence, the mothers, sisters, daughters, aunties, partners, without whom we would not have the kind of struggle and the kind of movement that we have in Chicago and in this country. I want to lift up the Say Her Name campaign that BYP 100 and other organizations has relaunched to remind us of people like Rukia Boyd, Sandra Bland, Corinne Gaines, and many others. All of this is to say that the struggle that brought 50 brothers home from prison, the struggle that ousted Anita Alvarez, the struggle that won a trauma center on the south side of Chicago were all collective struggles. And they teach us that the people united will never be. The people united will never be. Okay, so in the tradition of Latin American struggles, you know, many people have been disappeared from our communities through police violence and through mass incarceration. So I want to just hold up a few names, and I will say their names, and you bring their spirit into this room by saying presente. Quintonio LeGreer.
Presente.
Rakia Boyd.
Presente.
Laquan McDonald.
Presente.
Their spirit fuels and inspires us, and we draw upon their spirit and the spirit of many, many other struggles in this country and around the world. I'm reminded today in this particular political moment of the Grenadian Revolution and the slogan of that revolution, which was forward ever, backward never, and that should be our mantra today. Thank you very much, and we look forward to words from Angela Davis.
All right, up next, I would like to introduce Michael Brunson, the recording secretary of the Chicago Teachers Union. Give it up, everyone.
Good afternoon, everyone. Good to see you here. This is a nice crowd. So I just want to go back to January of 2015. Once again, my name is Michael Brunson. I'm one of the elected officers of the Chicago Teachers Union. I was approached in January of 2015 by Frank Chapman and Mike Elliott, and they had a really good idea that I immediately latched on to. You see, because before I came into the Chicago Teachers Union, I was a very strong proponent of local school councils in our Chicago public schools. How many educators are in the room here? Can I see how many educators? And I want to make clear, give yourselves a hand, because I want to be clear. Anyone that works in a school is an educator, a teacher, a paraprofessional, a clinician. If you work in the lunchroom, if you're in the hallways, you are an educator, because we need adults in our schools. So they came to me with an idea about civilian control or monitoring over the Chicago Chicago police. And I'm thinking, wow, this is great, because automatically we push for local school councils, which are public participatory control over our schools. We push for an elected representative school board to give the public control over our school boards. We push for a financial transaction tax so we can restrain Wall Street and LaSalle Street right here in Chicago. We've put conscientious trustees over our pensions so that we can direct some of that money back into our community. It makes perfect sense that there should be citizen oversight over our police department. So they came to us. And from there, I took it to the Chicago Teachers Union Human Rights Committee. It sailed on through there. We took it to the Chicago Teachers Union Black Caucus. Of course, we were in favor of it there. We took it to our political caucus for the elected leadership, Caucus of Rank and File Educators. They were on board with it. Finally, we took it to CTU Executive Board and House of Delegates, and we passed a resolution. I just want to read parts of that resolution. I won't read the whole thing. It says, whereas the Chicago Teachers Union, as a matter of our commitment to the fair treatment of all citizens in the city of Chicago, and our faith and commitment to the democratic process, has openly supported democratic bodies within the Chicago public school system, such as the local school councils, the professional personnel leadership committees, and elected representative school board. Therefore, be it resolved, as a matter of principle and consistency, that the Chicago Teachers Union will support a public initiative for a Civilian Police Accountability Council, CPAC. And be it further resolved that the Chicago Teachers Union will publicly advocate for such a council and ask that due research, thought, and open public dialogue be devoted to the creation of these councils at a district level. And be it finally resolved that Chicago Teachers Union demand that District Attorney Anita Alvarez, Chicago Police Superintendent Gary McCarthy, and Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel be held accountable for the unconscionable delay of our governmental institutions in addressing issues of excessive, unwarranted, unjustified, and lethal police force in the city of Chicago. So now you can see that's a little bit dated. Anita Alvarez is gone. Gary McCarthy is gone. That's two down and one to go, right? Okay. So I just want to say something before we leave here. Yesterday, I listened to Dr. Davis talk about the abolition of prisons, and I never really was able to wrap my head around it until she explained that it talks about the abolition of the conditions that create this massive incarceration and prison system. So I want to say that at our Chicago Teachers Union and with our foundation, we have been strong proponents of restorative justice and restorative practices. And we're trying to put that model into our Chicago public schools so that we do not have a school-to-prison pipeline, but we have sites where we create democratic citizens and get ready for the future. And I ask that you support us on that because we need a consistent program like that in our Chicago public schools. And if you want to hear more about what you can do to help us with that, I'm easy to get in contact with. I'm one of the officers of the Chicago Teachers Union. My name is Michael Brunson. Thank you for your time.
So I would like to invite Vicky Casanova Willis to the stage, please. She's speaking on behalf of the U.S. Human Rights Network and the Trinity Justice Watch team.
Thank you so much. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for being here. I want to give a huge shout out to my Trinity United Church of Christ family, where I serve as a member of the Justice Watch team. Thank you. I also would just like to be quick. I'll try to just read something for you. It piggybacks a little bit on what my husband was sharing about the importance of bringing human rights home and the role that the international human rights framework has. We need you. And what I want to share with you is just to put in context, recently we knew, for example, that we hosted the UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention within the last year. We here in Chicago. We also helped bring the UN Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent here. So for those who cannot imagine going to Geneva to testify and then come back, that's not the only way by far to make sure that we implement and use those tools to our behalf. So as we look at the fact that Ms. Amanda and the I have to call them survivors. Yes, they were victimized, but they were survivors, and they still are. And yet, think about the permanent stain that is placed when you are forced into extreme poverty, because not just were you stolen from your families and basically tortured into committing crime, into serving time for crimes that you did not commit. When you come out after all this heinous treatment and enslavement and the privatized system, then these records, these sentences, do not allow you in many cases to have a living wage. They don't allow you to work. So what I wanted you to be aware of is next week, the UN Special Rapporteur, that's another part of these human rights mechanisms, is going to deliver in Geneva his report on extreme poverty and human rights based on his recent report. His job was to witness and report on the current extent of extreme poverty here in the U.S. How does that connect to community control of police? What does that have to do with police torture here in Chicago? It has everything to do with it. He got this right in his report. In many cities and counties, the criminal, I say punishment system, is effectively a system for keeping the poor in poverty and generating revenue. Another point, when looking at toddlers and infants, 42% of all black children in the U.S. are poor, 32% of Hispanics, 30% of Native American infants and toddlers are poor. The figure for whites is 14%. He states, while there's no magic recipe for eliminating extreme poverty, each level of government must make its own good faith decisions. At the end of the day, particularly in a rich country like the U.S., the persistence of extreme poverty is a political choice made by those in power. With political will, it could readily be eliminated. So the bottom line is, as we heard earlier, we are the ones we've been waiting for. This is one of the pieces, the threads that run through continuing to keep our people in bondage. And we owe more to our children and our children's children, and we have to keep fighting. Human rights is more than just an idea or a phrase. In my new role as one of the board members for the U.S. Human Rights Network at the national level, there's a gap. This is the last thing I want to read to you from his statement. He says, on the component on racism, disability, and demonization of the poor. Demonization of the poor can take many forms. Racism is a constant dimension, and I regret that in a report that seeks to cover so much ground, that there is not more room to delve into that phenomenon. Okay, we're going to provide some information, we, to inform this report before it is shared with the UN on the 21st. We don't have to get on a plane, but we can use the power of the pen and technology because we do know how to connect those dots, and it must. To Sis Aislinn's words, we outnumber them. We have the power. Keep using it. Thank you, Ashe.
Thank you. We're going to have the cultural worker come up, and then after that, we're going to go immediately into introducing the keynote speaker. So can we have the cultural worker come up, please? Her name is Caprano.
My name is Caprano. Before, just really quickly, I do want to let Angela Davis know that, like, growing up, I used to have a really big afro, and I was very rebellious as a teenager. And my mother would always be like, oh, Angela Davis. Angela Davis, go wash the dishes. Angela Davis, go do this. My mother and my father. And I want to let you know that you have inspired me so much. I remember when I was singing the national anthem for the opening of the Jazz Festival in 2017, I was asking the national anthem. And I was like, you know, I don't like that anthem. But you know what anthem I do like? Lift Every Voice and Sing. So I got on that stage, and that is what I sang. And I told them, I was like, I'm not singing the national anthem. And when I'm doing things like that, it is your energy that is coursing through me. It is your inclusion of women, of trans people, of queer people, of all people that inspires me and that keeps me fighting. And I remember being given your autobiography for my birthday. And I thank my parents for that education, and I thank you for being you. And so this song is for you, and it is for those victims that have conquered, that I am also proud of, that have made it out of a system that does not love us, that does not protect us and claims to. But I do love you, and I will protect you as much as I can. So here is Beyoncé's Freedom.
Tryna rain on the thunder, turn the storm I'm new. I'ma walk, I'ma march on the regular, painting white flags blue. Lord forgive me, I've been running, running blind and true. I'ma rain on this bitter love, to the sweet I knew. I'm telling these tears gonna fall away, oh. May the last one burn into flames.
freedom, I can move. Freedom, freedom, cut me loose. Freedom, freedom, where are you? Cause I need freedom too. I break chains all by myself. Won't let my freedom rot in hell. Hey, I'ma keep running cause the winner don't quit on themselves, yeah.
I'ma wave through the waters till the tide don't move.
I'ma ride through your borders. Call me bulletproof. Lord, forgive me, I've been running, running blind and true. I'ma wave through your shallow love till the deep I knew.
I'm telling these years gonna fall away, fall away.
May the last one burn into flames. Freedom, freedom, I can move. Freedom, freedom, cut me loose. Freedom, freedom, where are you? Cause I need freedom too. I break chains all by myself. Won't let my freedom rot in hell. Hey, I'ma keep running cause the winner don't quit on the winner don't quit on the freedom. Freedom, where are you? Cause I need freedom too. I break chains all by myself. Well, let my freedom rot in hell. No,
I'ma keep running cause the winner don't quit on himself. Yeah, I don't quit, no. I don't quit, no. I don't quit, no.
Cause I break chains all by myself, but let my freedom burn in hell. Hey,
I'ma keep running, cause the winner I don't quit, and I don't quit on themselves. Thank you.
And thank you for inviting me here. Thank you so much.
I would like to invite up Mildred Williamson to introduce Dr. Angela Davis. Give it up for Mildred, everybody.
Greetings, everybody. Happy Father's Day, and also happy Father's Day for those of you who play a role as father in others' lives. There's a history and legacy here that's born out of the fight to make democracy, in fact, real for all Americans, which is a promise yet to be fulfilled. Post-Civil War Reconstruction was short-lived indeed, a mere 12 years, that could not undo all that was done and make things right for formerly enslaved people of almost 300 years prior, but it was enough time to form and perfect a strategy to get as close as possible, achieving the same, if not more, super profits by labor exploitation that were amassed during slavery by both the land-grabbing agrarian and the newly emerging industrial capitalists at the time. That strategy was to rule black people by terror, which combined with the passing and enforcement of unjust laws, with KKK and other forms of vigilante brutality that not only went unpunished, but we know many vigilante terrorists did their dirt by night and doubled as official law enforcers by day. That is in part what led to the formation of the NAACP in 1909, the International Labor Defense in 1925, the Southern Negro Youth Congress in 1937, the Civil Rights Conference in 1946, the 1950s and 60s Coalition for Civil Rights Organizations, including Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, followed by the Black Panther Party in 1966, and of course, the National Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression in 1973. These are all the anti-racist, radical democracy organization responses to this terror, which continues right into the 21st century in the form of modern mass incarceration, police brutality, including torture, terrorization of immigrants, Islamophobia, discrimination and violence against LGBT populations, especially transgender women of color. This is a history we must grasp in order to inform our 21st century strategy to stop racist and anti-human rights policies in this country and around the world. We must grasp this history in order to show that it is impossible to be for human rights and unconditionally support capitalism at the same time. There are participants in this not too distant history that understood and acted on these concepts in the formation of this organization. Four women in particular, not those in the extraordinary song by Nina Simone, but the four women who founded and shaped this organization I want to pay homage to at this time. There are four women, all of whom called Chicago their home at least four part of their lives. They contributed their skills and brilliance to one or more of these aforementioned organizations, including the building of this one. They are Sylvia Woods, who passed away in 1986, Josephine Wyatt, who passed away in 2017, Clarice Durham, who passed away this year, and Charlene Mitchell, now at the young age of 88. All four of these women were initiators and drivers of the Free Angela Davis and Political Prisoners Movement, with Charlene Mitchell as our first national organizer and Sylvia Woods as the leader of the Chicago chapter of the Angela Davis Defense Committee. These four women, extraordinary as they are, were comrades of William L. Patterson and Louise Thompson Patterson, who served as previous leaders of the International Labor Defense and the Civil Rights Congress. They have Esther Cooper Jackson, who's now 100 years old, and the late James Jackson of the Southern Negro Youth Congress to call as comrades too. These four women, founders of the NAARPR and early leaders of the successful anti-apartheid struggle with the South African people, these four women, among others, were the architects of the winning strategy to successfully free our sister Angela Davis and many other political prisoners since. It is with the love of this history and the people who made that history that I'm honored to introduce our keynote speaker for today, someone who too was most fortunate to have this community of extraordinary activist leaders as comrades, mentors, and friends. Someone who has, up to this very moment, has paid it forward with that same revolutionary vision and imagination to create and sustain a better world defined by justice, human rights, and peace. Welcome, Sister Angela Davis.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, first of all, let me thank all of you for coming out this afternoon, especially since it's Father's Day. And of course, thank CPAC. I think the last time I spoke here was at the beginning of the organizing of CPAC. Is that right, Frank? Oh. So, thank you, Frank. I see Ted Pearson in the house. Mildred, thank you, Jasmine, for keeping the program going. And I'm very moved by this gathering and hearing from people who have been targeted by torture, hearing from their loved ones. I feel really deeply honored to be in their presence, to be in the presence of these survivors of torture. And I also want to emphasize, we should not say victims. We should say survivors. And of course, this we've learned from feminist struggle, that words matter, and that we often have to reflect on the work that our vocabularies are doing. When we say victims, we objectify people. We deny their agency. When we say survivors, we acknowledge the capacity to resist
and to continue to fight the conditions that led to the violence inflicted on them. And maybe I should say a couple of words about feminist approaches and the significance of vocabularies. I don't think we should talk about criminal justice reform anymore. I mean, it rolls off our tongues, doesn't it? Whenever we witness these horrors, we sort of automatically call for criminal justice reform. But the criminal justice system has been reformed over and over and over and over and over again. And it only leads to more violence. So let's see if we can fix our tongues to say abolition. Abolition and not reform. Because, I mean, I make this point because, you know, oftentimes we ask ourselves, when is it ever going to change? It appears as if we are fighting the same battles over and over and over and over again. As a matter of fact, many of us can trace our political trajectories with stories of those who were the targets of vigilante racist violence or police violence. I can remember so clearly the cases in my own childhood, Emmett Till especially. But if we assume that nothing has changed, then it makes no sense to continue to struggle. So we have to figure out how to recognize where we have been victorious, how change has happened as a result of generations of activists in struggle. And certainly, even if we haven't managed to undo all of the structural violence of racism, we've learned how to better understand it. And that puts us in a better position to dismantle it. There was a time when we assumed that what we needed to do was to guarantee that the individual who was the perpetrator of the violence be brought to justice. And of course, individuals have to be rendered accountable. But we can prosecute cop after cop after cop after cop after cop, and the system still remains a purveyor of racist violence. And I think we've learned that over the years, and we have to be proud that is progress. And our vocabularies represent that progress. And that is why I think it is so important to pay attention to, you know, how we represent things. We, you know, there was a time we used the term deaf and dumb. But disabled communities and struggle have taught us the extent to which terms like that dehumanize people. Trans and queer communities have allowed us to recognize how what we assume is normal is ideologically constructed. You know, gender is not binary in the way it has been represented for who knows how long. But that's not actually what I was going to say here. That's just a sort of a parenthetical observation. Now, I wanted to point out, in connection with the observation about the use of the term survivor, you know, rather than victim, I wanted to point out that Toni Morrison once said in a commencement address she gave many years ago that the function of freedom is to free someone else. As individuals, our freedom is only meaningful if we use it to broaden the reach of freedom, to make others free. And it seems to me that this has been the guiding principle of the Chicago Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression since its founding in 1973. And I want to join Mildred in paying tribute to Sylvia Woods and of course, Josephine Wyatt and Clarice Durham. I really miss them, and they are here. Their presence is very palpable. Charlene Mitchell. And all of these women used every ounce of their freedom to secure the freedom of others. And their fighting spirit continues to animate the work of the Alliance. I'd really like to congratulate those who have kept the Alliance alive over the decades. It's been 45 years. I can hardly believe that it's been 4.5 decades. I just observed, was it the 44th anniversary of my acquittal? How many years has it been? Since 72, so yeah, 46 years, okay. 46 years ago, I was acquitted on June 4th. And we knew that we could not dismantle the organization, the campaign that achieved my freedom, but we needed to strengthen and broaden it in order to bring home as many people as possible. So over the years, we have achieved victories, but we've also suffered defeats. We won freedom for Reverend Ben Chavis and the Wilmington Ten, for Joanne Little, for Carlos Feliciano, for a number of the Attica brothers, but some people are still in prison. Mondo Waylonga died. Ed Poindexter is still in prison. Leonard Peltier, one of the longest held political prisoners, is still behind bars, and we really need to bring Leonard home. Mumia Abu-Jamal. We also worked on the case of Assata Shakur. And I could go on and on and on. More recently, of course, in this city, we worked to prevent the deportation of Razmia Odeh. And we were not entirely successful in that battle, but Razmia continues to fight back. She's living in Jordan now, and I talked to her not very long ago about the fact that we were both in the Netherlands, and she's traveling, she's speaking out, especially urging people to protest the Israeli assaults on people in Gaza who are simply trying to observe the 70th anniversary of the Nakba, who are saying that we do not give up, we do not accept defeat, and people in struggle all around the world can look to the Palestinians for that steadfastness and that persistence and that belief that freedom is still on the horizon. But I wanted to mention a few people who have been released. I just learned that Debbie Africa from one of the MOVE sisters was just released. Was it yesterday or day before? Herman Bell was just released. And you know, Herman Wallace of the Angola 3 said that he did not want to die in Angola. He was released a few years ago and had his wish of not dying in Angola, but unfortunately, he died about 3 or 4 days after his release. I mention Herman Wallace because I just had the opportunity to see Robert King and Albert Woodfox, who was just recently released from Angola. Robert King spent, was it 25 years in solitary confinement? Something like that. But Albert Woodfox spent 45 years in solitary confinement. And he still thinks about those he left behind and is dedicating his life to continuing the struggle to eventually abolish these horrendous institutions of punishment. And both of them are really remarkable. I think I was saying during the question and answer period last night at the Chicago Teachers Union, it was a great event. It's good to come to Chicago and speak to the Teachers Union and then to speak to CPAC. I was saying that Robert King pointed out that many people are surprised that, quote, that he's not crazy after spending so many decades in solitary confinement. And his response is, but I am. He said, but I am, because it's impossible to undergo that kind of treatment without being marked by it. And so he understands that, and he understands the need to get help and talk to people about those traumas and not pretend that he's the same person he was 25, 45 years ago. But I wanted to move from a discussion of what they're doing now to say a few words about violence and about racism. There is no innocent racism. You know, here in this city, the school closings that are a part of a neoliberal strategy to transform education entirely into a commodity that has to be purchased. Chicago is Chicago's at the forefront of a lot of things, good and bad. And Chicago is the pilot program for the country, you know, how to completely commodify education. And something like 90% of the kids in Chicago school are black or brown. Am I right? And so that's about racism. And it's connected to violence. And I think it's important for us to recognize the connections between what might appear to be a sort of nonviolent expression of racism to the violence that is at the core of racism. As I mentioned, I was in the Netherlands not too long ago, and I read a book that was written by scholar activist Gloria Becker, and it's called White Innocence. the paradoxes of racism and colonialism, something like that. And so she's trying to describe the way the Dutch think of themselves. And she says, they say, we are a small nation, innocent. We are inherently anti-racist. Moreover, we do not have bad intentions. And of course, the Dutch have always represented themselves in that way, right? But she emphasizes that sense of self that is this sense of national self is generated by a society that, quote, and I'm quoting Gloria's words, has managed to convince itself that nearly 400 years of colonialism have miraculously not left any traces of racism, either in culture, history, or language, representations of the self and the other, or in institutions. And so now you see in the Netherlands this really vibrant movement against racism that is emerging. You know, Europe thinks of itself as white, despite the fact that there are huge numbers of people of color, people from the global south. And we see movements against police violence there. And I think it's important for us to connect with what is going on in France. Just last week, I had the opportunity to meet with a young woman whose brother, Adama Traoré, was killed by the police on the outskirts of Paris in the banlieue. And it was only because her family comes from Mali. No other reason. The point that I want to try to make is that racism is always about violence. Wherever you find racism, there will be violence. Lynchings, vigilante violence, prison violence, police violence. And this is one of the reasons why there's been a campaign in this country to deal with the monuments, right? The statues of the Confederate generals and the Ku Klux Klan's people. And I think that's a very important movement. It's just that we can't simply argue that they need to be gotten rid of, and then we forget about them, because we have to remember, we have to figure out, you know, how to understand the impact that racism has had on the history of this country. But also there are these stubbornly persistent signs of racist, I would say, slavery, colonialism, that we don't even think about. The usages of indigenous people in the names of sports teams. And I don't understand how we could continue, you know, to say Washington Redskins or Atlanta Braves or Cleveland Indians or Chicago, what is it? Chicago Blackhawks. So I think it's really important to recognize what Dr. King talked about as the indivisibility of justice. If we speak out against racist police violence, we have to recognize that indigenous people continue to be the targets of a whole range of racist violences. Violence at the border. Several people, Barbara and others, have talked about the anti-immigrant racism that has been, you know, so fueled up by the person who occupies the top of executive power in this country. you know, that xenophobia. I was, yesterday I spoke at the teachers union and had a great meeting with the teachers, and I was pointing out that we all now know that 8 billionaires, 8, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 8 billionaires own more than half of the entire planet's population. That is more than 3 point some billion people. And that is totally obscene. It is totally obscene. You know, I was saying last night that actually the elephant in the room is always capitalism. So we have to figure out a vocabulary to be able to speak about this. And that even though we know about this enormous concentration of wealth, people like Trump successfully end up persuading some people, white people who are having difficult economic circumstances, that their impoverishment is a direct result of immigrants and not of people like Jeff Bezos and Mark Zuckerberg and, you know, all these 8 billionaires. As we approach the third decade of the 21st century, well, we've come a long way and haven't come that far at all. 10 more minutes? Okay. I wanted to say a few words about the importance of linking up with struggles around the world. Anti-Muslim racism, Islamophobia, has to be understood as intersecting with and reinvigorating anti-Black, anti-Asian, anti-Latinx racism. And racist violence, when it is inflected with misogyny, is especially fatal. I'm not sure how many of you know about Marielle Franco in Brazil, who was assassinated back in March. And we need to not think of ourselves as so ensconced in domestic struggles that we fail to recognize how important our international solidarity is. And I think that I have only a couple of minutes left, so I think what I want to say is that the struggles that we have engaged in against institutionalized police violence are very much related to what is happening in Europe and in Australia and Latin America and Africa and Asia and the Middle East. And we have to learn how to value those who have expressed solidarity for our struggles in the U.S. The solidarity of Palestinian activists. And I don't know how the movement for Black Lives would have unfolded had it not been for the fact that Palestinian activists immediately offered solidarity and were at the forefront of an international solidarity movement that further emboldened people in this country to stand up and fight police violence. Now, Chicago is a place where you recognize this. I think more than most other places in the country. I'm always happy to come to Chicago because even though there are many difficult stories, Chicago represents hope to me. And I was saying at the the rally at the event for the Chicago Teachers Union last night, I remember when I first saw Karen Lewis on television talking back to Rahm Emanuel. And I said, who is this woman? And the teachers, Karen, and the teachers union taught teachers all over the country that they could stand up and fight back. And there have been teacher walkouts in many states as a direct result of what happened here in Chicago. The movement that you generated to protest the killing of Laquan McDonald, that emboldened people. The fact that here in Illinois, death row prisoners were released. How many years ago was that? I mean, we thought it was supposed to be the beginning of a trend, but unfortunately, that's a struggle that we still need to conduct. But Chicago is a great place to be if you are a radical activist. I mean, you have amazing organizations, the Alliance, CPAC, you have Asada's Daughters, you have Black Youth Project, 100. It's, Black Lives Matter. This is the place to be if you want to try to bring about change in this country. So I want to wish you success. I want to say welcome home to all of the survivors of torture, and thank you. Thank you for keeping the fires burning. Thank you to all of the wonderful cultural performers Capano? Capano. I think I think Beyonce better watch out, because I really like your version. let me say, we who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. Thank you very much. Yeah.